Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals are provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information. The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed in this podcast are solely of those of the hosts.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Sam Mazur, and I am not Chris the Chumanchu, but I am joined tonight with two producers and hosts, talking with Coleman Birch and Crystal Nora. Say hi, guys.
Hey.
Hey.
So our guest tonight is Dr. Alex Golek to discuss PrEP in adolescence. But first, Crystal, can you please remind us about the show?
We are the pediatric medicine podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
We have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Alex Golek. He's an assistant professor of pediatrics at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and an attending physician in the Division of Adolescent and Young Adult Medicine at Johns Hopkins Children's Center. His clinical and research interests are adolescent preventative health, substance use screening and treatment, and LGBTQ plus health. Today, he teaches us how to appropriately prescribe and manage PrEP, PEP, and DoxyPEP to support patients in HIV prevention.
Get prepared for a great conversation.
Well done. We don't need Chris here for this. This is fantastic.
I got it.
Yeah. So hi, Dr. Golek. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
First, because we're more of an informal group, is it okay if I can call you by your first name?
Absolutely. Please call me Alex.
All right, Alex. So let's start to get to know you a little bit. We love to ask a one-liner here on the Cribsider. So essentially, if you wouldn't mind giving a one-liner to describe yourself, maybe something you do outside of medicine.
Well, I am a clinician educator with a focus in adolescent medicine and addiction medicine, and I am a plant dad, cat dad, and terrible paddleboarder.
All right. How many times have you fallen on paddleboard? Is that why you're considered a terrible paddleboarder?
Oh, no. I lack any core muscle strength, so I tend to do a lot of, you know, thinking I have some sort of tremor-based illness when I'm out on the water.
Seems very safe.
I guess another question just to get to know you is I'm curious to know, what is your favorite failure and what did you learn from it?
I think one of my favorite failures, which is a phrase I don't often think about, is in my undergrad years, I tried learning how to surf. And this was out in California. And I did not do very well at it. And I got caught in a rip current, which fortunately I'd learned a little bit about. But there was another person who was in that rip current who was maybe 50 feet away from me. And I remember just utilizing every language I had in my brain, every signal I could send to like tell them to swim away from me because we are on opposite sides of that current. And things worked out okay. I managed to swim back. Lifeguards were able to get the other person. But it was one of those things where I think I reflected upon all of what we do is it's a team effort. And every one of us plays some role, even if it feels insignificant.
Yeah, I mean, we do a lot of team sport type of things here. I think we've talked a lot about on the show that medicine's a team sport too, and that everything we do really needs to be team-based. And that's how we've brought in a lot of different guests, and that's how we're all learning every day. And that's why we show up to this one every single day, even though, you know, we've been trying to learn medicine for years. And like, I got stupid questions. I need to know stuff. Here, team, help me out. So I think that, you know, translates perfectly to what we're talking about as well.
100%.
What is a favorite piece of advice you've received throughout your career?
One piece of advice that I received as a resident from a wonderful teacher and pediatric nephrologist was that unless the patient is coding in front of you, you may take a bathroom break. And it was a fantastic reminder to take care of yourself so that you can take care of others.
I love that. I think it's important that we prioritize our wellness in this work. And so I remember being a resident and feeling like there was just no time to even take a bathroom break or drink some water. And so, you know, I know you're a plant dad, but we all need water and sunshine in order to grow. So I think it's a great way to think about things.
And it was just so lovely to hear that permission in a system that often makes it feel like we don't have that available to us.
Coleman, I think we can get on with the case. We got a lot of good things to talk about. And if you want to read the case for us, because you wrote a fantastic one, let's get started. Hey, Cribsiders listeners, whether this is your first episode or you've been with us since day one, you know our goal has always been to share real wisdom about practicing medicine. So let's talk about something that actually changed my day-to-day as a hospitalist, and that's fig scrubs. I can't walk into a clinic or hospital without seeing people in fig scrubs, and I get it, I wear them too. They're incredibly soft, form-fitting, and durable, and it's not just dust. If you've been watching a certain popular ER drama on TV, yep, they're in figs too. These scrubs get it. That's what drew me in and what keeps me coming back. And because we work with kids and kids come with messes, I love that figs are antimicrobial. When stuff gets on your scrubs, and it will, you just wash them and they come out wrinkle-free. I've washed mine well over 50 times and they still look brand new. All of that and so much more is why we've teamed up with figs. Now, Cribsiders listeners can get 15% off. Just go to wearfigs.com and use code FIGSRX. That's WEARFIGS.com and use code FIGSRX for 15% off.
So we have a patient at Cash Like Children's. Preston E. Profi is a 16-year-old male at birth who presents to our primary care office for a routine physical. He weighs 58 kilos and is generally healthy. In the last 6 months, he reports being sexually active with both male and female partners, uses condoms sometimes, and was treated for chlamydia about 3 months ago. So, Alex, let's just start with the basics. Can you exactly define what is PrEP and how does it differ from PEP?
Of course. So, HIV PrEP, which is an abbreviation we'll use for pre-exposure prophylaxis, is the use of any medication to prevent the acquisition of HIV in folks who are at higher risk. So I'm thinking back to that epidemiology triangle that we learned way back in medical school.
And how does that, I don't want to get lost in the alphabet soup because we'll be using some abbreviations. How does PrEP differ from PEP?
Ah, excellent question. PEP stands for post-exposure prophylaxis. So that is us providing medication treatment to someone who may have been already exposed to the HIV virus. So we're trying to prevent the seroconversion of HIV exposure into a HIV infection.
Awesome. So let's kind of, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about PrEP to begin with here. Let's talk a little, you mentioned risk factors, right? People who could be at risk for HIV. Can we talk a little bit about the indications for PrEP? So who are those patients that you think might be indicated, or who should we consider for PrEP?
Well, that has changed so much in the 13 years that we have had PrEP. And when this medication was initially approved only in 2012, it had a fairly limited approval for adults who may have had one STI in the past 12 months, or who were having, I believe it was anal intercourse without condom use. That has expanded over the years to now include adolescents, to include folks who are not assigned male at birth, and has expanded to the point that if any patient requests PrEP, it is something that you should offer and discuss with them. So I'm going to apologize for a vague answer, but really anyone who might have any risk for HIV acquisition should be considered as a candidate for PrEP.
And just to maybe be clear, so I see a lot of patients kind of coming in for all sorts of sexual and reproductive health needs. Are you saying that any of those patients could possibly be a candidate for PrEP?
Absolutely. So patients who engage in sex regardless of their sex assigned at birth, regardless of the sexes of the folks that they are having intercourse with, who may have any sort of risk factor such as inconsistent condom use, multiple partners, folks who may be at risk for HIV acquisition outside of sex, including persons who inject drugs, are also candidates for PrEP. So there are so many reasons that we really should be thinking about this in so many of our patients.
And are there any patient populations you would say would be a higher risk or benefit more from PrEP? So patients that instead of them coming to you or you're saying considering, you're like, I actually think you should be like, I'm going to actually push it upon you, that type of thing.
Absolutely. Patients who have a history of a sexually transmitted infection in the past, I'm going to arbitrarily say 6 months, but I leave this to your discretion. Patients who have higher risk networks. So this is where it's important for you to know the epidemiology of the area that you practice in. This may also include folks who are male identified and having sex with men. This may include folks in urban populations. So for example, where I practice in Baltimore, there are higher risks of STIs. So there are many factors to consider when perhaps prompting a PrEP discussion with your patients.
And when you're taking a sexual history in a patient, what are the big screening questions that we should be thinking of when thinking about starting a patient on PrEP?
The important questions to ask are the kinds of sex that a person is engaged in, meaning what body parts are interacting with what other body parts, what the relationship is with those people. Of course, thinking about factors like safety, if there is any sort of transactionality, such as payment or receipt of things like food or shelter, and thinking about if there is any knowledge of the sexual health of those partners. So all of those factors in combination are really important when asking about a sexual health history. And it can be awkward, especially with teenagers. And one of the things that I often do is I acknowledge that it may seem like an awkward conversation and that I am asking because my role as an adolescent medicine specialist is to make sure that I am understanding their overall health and health risks so that I can keep them safe and even healthier.
Alex, let's say I am that patient. You know, I'm Preston, I'm in your clinic and we're talking about PrEP. What language can you like help me walk through? Like, what's your script? How are you bringing up PrEP to your patients?
Yeah. So Preston, I understand that you've shared a lot of information with me today, and I appreciate you being so honest with telling me some of these more sensitive things. I noticed that you mentioned that you were worried about the chlamydia infection that you had a few months ago. And I was wondering if we could talk a little bit more about ways to keep yourself safe while having sex, including prevention of infections like HIV or other sexually transmitted infections.
And then one thing I'd love to follow up on is one of the things I think that makes working with adolescents so rewarding and challenging is that sometimes there's like some ambivalence. So I'm like, yeah, you know, whatever, like maybe I'll do this, maybe I'm not. So let's say Preston is just looking at you and is like, I don't know if this is the right decision. What kind of encouragement do you give to adolescent providers, other pediatricians, folks who just take care of young people and kind of rolling with that resistance sometimes?
Absolutely. I love that phrase, rolling with resistance, because I will lean into every bit of motivational interviewing that I can find and really listen for those little things that might indicate that they are leaning one way or another in the midst of their ambiguity. I use the example of being worried about the chlamydia infection because most adolescents I speak with and work with generally have some degree of concern about having had a sexually transmitted infection, whether it is some degree of concern for their their physical health or some degree of shame or guilt. And that may often be a springboard just to further that conversation. And you can consider asking, you know, are there certain scenarios that might make you change your mind or make you say, no, it's absolutely worth starting something to prevent HIV.
So, you know, I think this was a great speech and a great kind of introductory piece to say, hey, this is kind of what we got for you. So I'd say let's start, move on to the case and say Preston is interested in starting PrEP. But before we kind of talk about the nitty gritty of like what we should be doing, what tests we need to do, all that type of stuff, I was curious if you could talk a little bit about access before we get going on this. So maybe what disparities do you see in at least access to PrEP? Are we going to be able, am I going to be able to start this for him? He might be interested, but am I even going to be able to start it? You know, I was wondering if you could comment a little bit on that before we get going.
Absolutely. There are, as with many elements of our healthcare system, disparities in terms of access to providers who are knowledgeable about PrEP, access to pharmacies. Even here in Baltimore, we are having increasing pharmacy deserts where patients are not able to physically go to a location and pick up their medication because they've been closing. And there is still some bias in our system in which we may look at minority populations and urban populations and say this is just inherent and not understand that, no, we should be discussing PrEP with so many of these individuals.
Yeah, I think that's so important to recognize, you know, how many patients could really benefit from this. Going back to our case, so we did a great job educating Preston. He is interested in starting PrEP. So what sort of things should we be assessing in Preston before initiating treatment?
So there are three formulations of PrEP that are available in the United States, and hopefully a fourth formulation that will be coming on the market in the next year or two. The one that was initially approved is often called by its brand name, Truvada, but it is tenofovir. I can't say the next two letters, so I'm going to call it TDF, and then M-tricitabine is the second component. So I believe I'll just call it TDF for the sake of this conversation. This medication has the longest history. It's been around for 13 years. It's available as a generic. So therefore, many insurance plans may cover it. The other two, one is a different formulation of tenofovir called TAF, also known by its brand name, Descovy. And then the third that is currently approved is cabotegravir, which is a injection given every 2 months after a 1 month loading period. And it's also known by its brand name, Apretude. The TAF and the cabotegravir are not available as generics, so they may be unavailable to many of our patients. The other thing that I'll add before I go too far into the details of considering PrEP is that it is important that we all understand the laws of the state in which we're practicing and whether or not HIV prevention is something that can be offered as a confidential service to adolescents, and if there are any mechanisms available through the state or other organizations to allow for access and confidential access to that medication.
And I think the point around access and making sure that we're having confidential care is reminds me that we've done some really wonderful podcast episodes with the Cripsiders talking about how to take a sexual health history and how to provide that confidential care. And so I know this is something that we'll continue to talk about and really kind of strengthening that skill. But getting into the nitty gritty, I have Preston here in clinic. He is ready to start PrEP. What labs am I ordering for him before starting this medication? And then maybe later we can talk about how might I explain the differences to the patient in deciding what to choose.
Of course. So for Preston, I would likely consider either TDF or TAF. which are once daily oral medications, so taken by mouth once a day. In order to start this medication, we need to, one, confirm that Preston does not have HIV. So an HIV fourth generation antigen antibody test is an absolute. If there has been recent possible exposure or recent PrEP use, so I know in this case, Preston has not been on PrEP before, but for patients who may have used it in the past year or so, we do want to get an HIV RNA. The other labs that we should get include any recommended STI testing, including syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, and perhaps trichomonas or mycoplasma, depending on risk. We should obtain a hepatitis C antibody, as well as a hepatitis B surface antigen, so that we know the hepatitis B status of the patient. And lastly, a creatinine, and then in the case of TAF, we want to get a lipid panel.
Awesome. So that's a pretty simple test from primary care. You know, we order these tests a lot, you know, hepatitis screening, STI screening, and very much lipid panels and BMPs. That's something we can do for sure. Of that group, the big question is, okay, what happens if we get something abnormal? Can we start? Can we not start? It sounds like if you have HIV, starting a single medicine is inappropriate, and that is a hard stop. Short of that, what else is a hard stop regarding all of those tests?
So one other contraindication is impaired renal clearance. So a clearance of less than 60 for TDF and less than 30 for TAF. A allergy to the medication, which we wouldn't know in someone who hasn't taken it. But outside of that, that's really it.
So hepatitis, for example, if you have either hepatitis A, A, B, or C, and leave it for only screening for B and C, it sounds like those are not hard contraindications. Is that correct?
That is correct. The reason we screen for hepatitis B is because the tenofovir in both the TDF and TAF may help partly treat a hepatitis B infection, and we worry about having a rebound flare-up if we did not know that there was a hepatitis B infection in the young person that we're treating.
Awesome. That sounds perfect. And then we'll kind of talk a little bit later about monitoring and whether these numbers are going to change on us and whether we need to keep making, you know, testing and when things would be a stop. But so you gave a great outline between TAF, TDF, and the injectable option. What are the pros and cons between those, and how might you choose between them for Preston?
So much of it is going to boil down to access. What is going to be accessible to that young person, to Preston specifically, depending on silly things like health insurance, or if there are programs in the state that may provide one or either of those medications. The injectable, unfortunately, is really, really challenging to access for adolescents. One, because it needs to be administered often in a specialty clinic, and insurance is reluctant to cover it. So for many patients, TDF or Truvada will be the first thing I consider. However, because we know that TAF or Descovy is less likely to have impact on renal function and also on bone density, which is ever so important to our young people, TAF may actually be the preferable oral PrEP medication, but because it's not a generic, it may not be what's available. So one of the two orals, TDF, often because of access.
Glad that we were able to walk through kind of how to choose between the two oral medications. Can we circle back? What's the timing for the injectable medication?
Of course. So the injectable medication, the cabotegravir, is often done at intervals of 2 months. So every 2 months, you receive this medication. However, when starting the medicine, there are options either to do two injections 1 month apart or to do 4 weeks of oral cabotegravir. In clinical practice, I don't know of anyone who does the oral option because it is just as effective to do two injections 1 month apart and then to proceed with every 2 month injections.
You know, when I was just thinking, insurance obviously plays a big role in this and access, and we've kind of talked about that to begin with. Are there any differences between efficacy in the three different medicines? And maybe you could talk a little bit about, if so, does it depend on your adherence to the med as well?
I think you just spoke the biggest factor in efficacy, which is adherence. So comparatively, these are all effective medications. I would not prioritize one or the other over the effectiveness based on pharmacology. However, because the oral medications require once daily dosing for optimal effectiveness, that is a huge factor to consider, especially in our adolescent and young adult populations. I will add that the TDF, or Truvada, has had a few studies looking at off-label use or on-demand use, sometimes called 2-1-1 dosing, that is considered to be as effective as once daily dosing for folks who may be at higher but more episodic risk. But this is not an FDA approval of that medication. So many ways to consider, but absolutely the adherence is going to be your number one factor when having this discussion with patients.
And can you just take us through that 2-1-1 just so I understand? Is that just like, hey, I'm expected to have sex on Friday, so I'm going to preemptively take 2-3 days before or something? Is that how that works?
Actually, it's even shorter than that. It is 2 hours before. Okay. So it is.
That seems more realistic.
Yes. Is two pills at least 2 hours before the expected exposure, and then one pill every 24 hours for at least 2 days after your last exposure.
Gotcha. And that's good to know. Obviously, we generally promote FDA pieces, but we also appreciate expert opinion in studies that have tried to do things that are off-label. So thank you for taking through
us. Yeah, and this is actually, great information available on the CDC website, and actually Howard Brown, which is a community organization in Chicago, has a wonderful page on 2-1-1 PrEP.
One of the things that I'm curious about is that we've got Preston, we're starting, we got the screening labs, we're talking through the regimen. This is a lot of information. What does follow-up look like? How often should we be following up patients who were starting PrEP? Walk us through what that looks like for a patient.
Of course. So it is a lot of information to present. And hopefully it is a discussion that leads to, the best decision being made by Preston for his health in the moment. And if that includes starting PrEP, great. Let's start PrEP. For example, let's say he chooses to start a daily medication like TDF or TAF. I typically would plan on a phone or message check-in in about 2 weeks, really checking around, hey, were you able to obtain the medication? How are you doing with medication adherence in terms of taking it every single day or as close to every single day as possible? And then I would want to see him in clinic or by telehealth every 3 months. Now, the reason we've selected every 3 months is because this is the recommended frequency for HIV testing. So the reason we recommend this is so that we are not missing any patients who may have not been using PrEP at its optimal level and may have acquired HIV. Because if we are continuing PrEP in someone who has acquired HIV, we're doing them a disservice by only partially treating that infection.
And we kind of talked about HIV testing before, doing the antibody antigen test versus if you had been on PrEP for a year, then you would use, or 6 months to a year, you would use the RNA test. In this retesting you're doing every 3 months, is this the RNA viral load?
That is a recent change. And yes. we want to assess their risk with the RNA test if there has been a higher risk exposure. Now, if you perhaps had a one-off and a patient who had no risks in the 3 months but was continuing on the medication, maybe then we could get away with just the antigen antibody.
Gotcha. Does this follow-up look any differently for folks who are taking the injectable?
So because the injectable is on a every 2 month schedule, they are recommended to have an HIV test every 4 months.
That's helpful to know kind of the timing. So it aligns. I was wondering, I was like, every month, because it's a lot for some folks. Yeah.
And then you throw the 1 month lead in and you look at the charts and it's like, do HIV testing at 1, 5, 9, 13 months. It's like neurology and trying to do math.
And what about the kidney function? Are we also testing kidney function and lipid panels? Like, what are we testing for the other labs? Are we monitoring those as well?
So for the oral medications, we want to check the kidney function about once a year in folks who are otherwise healthy and do not have known kidney disease, and more often, meaning every 3 or 6 months, in folks who may have higher risk. For the injectable PrEP, this one is actually sparing to the kidneys and the liver, so we don't need to check either of those. And then to circle back, the TAF, this one you should check a lipid panel about once a year.
Gotcha. And then for that as well, do these medicines actually cause kidney injury, or are we just looking for other etiologies that the kidney function would decline and therefore you wouldn't be able to excrete it?
The TDF has a low but possible risk of causing some kidney injury. So this is why we monitor the creatinine at least once yearly. And of course, that risk is lower in folks who have no other risk factors. So generally speaking, our adolescents and young adults who are generally healthy are folks who I feel comfortable monitoring once a year.
And are there any other side effects that patients might have with any of these medications that you're counseling them on or looking out for?
The biggest side effects I think about are what is often called the startup syndrome. Having things like upset stomach, nausea, headache in the first few days or few weeks of taking the medication. The other thing to consider is that the TDF is a fairly large pill. It's about a centimeter and a half size tablet. It's a multivitamin size. So that can be challenging for some patients and maybe a practical reason why we consider TAF instead.
Thinking about like the size of the pill and thinking about things that we can do to help promote adherence, are there things that you recommend when how to take a larger pill or just how to take a pill every single day for adolescents?
We're just going to use our motivational interviewing skills over and over and over again. But even small things like having pill boxes to give them so that they have some sort of mechanism for organizing themselves, figure out what helps them stay organized in other aspects of their life, whether it is alarms on their phone or things in certain locations of their living space. It is challenging. It is and not limited to just PrEP for our adolescents.
And I just had one final follow-up question for adherence before we move on in our case. And you might not have this data, which is totally fine. Is there any data on change in efficacy based on number of missed doses? So for example, hey, if you miss it once a week, it goes to 86% or something along those lines. So you can kind of figure out, okay, we're kind of batting, 400, 500, or you're like, look, this ain't going to work. So like, let's just give up on it because you taking it every other day is just giving us a shot at zero. Does that data exist? It's okay if it doesn't.
So the data exists for TDF or Truvada, and generally speaking, missing one or two doses per week still keeps you in the upper 90% range for effectiveness. I am not certain about the TAF, nor am I certain about the window for the cabotegravir injection in terms of how many days late can you be to still consider it effective.
Yeah. But that's great. It sounds like it's more effective than you think, you know, versus we often talk about DOACs or things like that. And you're like, oh, if you missed a dose, then you get a PE. You didn't fail the medicine. One dose was gone, you know. You know, that means it was the, you know, it means it doesn't count. So that's really, really helpful. Okay. Coleman, do you think you want to move on to the next part of the case, or does anyone else have any questions they want to ask?
Yeah, let's do it. So Preston has been on TAF for about 6 months, doing very well. He comes back to our office about 6 months later. Now he is in a monogamous relationship, and his partner has recently tested negative for routine STIs, including HIV. He asked you about discontinuing PrEP, saying that he doesn't want to take pills every day, and he feels like he's a little bit lower risk now. How long should patients remain on PrEP, and when is that transition point when we should think about stopping it?
So the short answer is they are welcome to stop the medication at whatever point they feel ready, depending on what else might be happening within their lives. So there is no minimum duration. There is no tail to the medication. And this may be something that we talk about when we're starting the medicine, that it really is has a high degree of autonomy. And patients are welcome to make those decisions. Of course, I encourage them to make those decisions in conversation with me and the healthcare team. But in this particular case, it sounds like Preston's risk factors have changed significantly. And I may want to just have a few follow-up questions around the confidence in the information that his partner is providing. Other perhaps safety questions around the relationship, just making sure there aren't any red or yellow flags out there. But if everything sounds like it is progressing well, and I genuinely hope it is, then we might make a shared decision to say, it sounds like your risk has changed. You are at much lower risk for HIV, and this might be a good time to stop the medication. And of course, if things change, in the future, and either the relationship changes or something else happens, please let me know and we can reconsider it.
And do you have any, you know, there might be a teenager who might come to you and be like, hey, I think I'm good. Is there anything that you would say, I don't think you're as good as you think? Is there anything objective that you would say is kind of a hard cutoff for you to say, you know what, I really think we should reconsider that. This is the reason why.
Well, there are many scenarios in which I wish I could make my patients continue a particular medication or therapy, but unfortunately, I just don't have that power, and perhaps it's good that I don't. So it is a shared decision. And of course, I might have times when I raise more concerns for patients who may be in open relationships or patients who may be continuing to engage in anonymous or transactional sex, to really kind of refocus on the risks and benefits and to see if I can perhaps explore some of those motivations further and see if there is an opportunity for them to change their mind about the decision they want to make.
Awesome. So Coleman, let's keep moving on then. I think we're making some decisions, and let's find out what happens next.
Yeah. So we're going to fast forward a little bit again. So Preston is going to come back to our office 6 months later. He tells you that 2 days ago, he had unprotected sex with a new partner and is worried that they might be HIV positive. And he asks you about the next steps. So switching gears a little bit to talk about PEP or post-exposure prophylaxis, what are some times that we should think about prescribing that?
Well, before I go too far into that, I think this is absolutely one of those clinical scenarios in which you lean in on the resources of the team so that you have some time and space to engage in this conversation with Preston. If you have colleagues, perhaps in social work, seeing if they're also available for support because this is not just a medical decision, it's very much an emotional decision when someone learns this kind of information. Now, with that being said, there is effective post-exposure prophylaxis, or PEP, to reduce the chance that if his body was exposed to the HIV virus, that does not take up residence in his white blood cells. So that is where I would start with Preston in terms of a medical recommendation that he start HIV post-exposure prophylaxis as soon as possible, like today.
And so let's talk about it. So if you wouldn't mind kind of taking us through medication options, indications, timing of treatment, kind of all the things that you would talk to Preston about right now.
Of course. So in terms of timing of treatment, I think this is the one that is most important. Timing is as soon as possible and optimally within 3 days or 72 hours of that exposure. Of course, I won't harp on 72 versus 73 hours, but once we get past that 3 day window, the effectiveness really drops off. In terms of options for treatment, there are two different combinations that are FDA approved. Both utilize TDF with an integrase inhibitor, such as raltegravir, dolutegravir, or a combination of darunavir and ritonavir. So in any of the scenarios, your patient will be taking at least two medications. Now, I will add a caveat in that there are some scenarios in which a single pill, a three medication combination treatment may be recommended. And this is a case in which you should lean in on any experts that you have available to you, whether within your own institution or through the National HIV Consortium, which is a phone number that you can call during business hours.
Which we can put in the show notes for everybody as well. Perfect. And so, all right, so it sounds like we have as soon as possible, within 72 hours, ideally, is where the efficacy is. But you would definitely tell someone to take it as soon as they can, regardless of what the time is. And then the medicines are the TDF plus one of these integrase inhibitors. As far as dosing goes, what changes here? How long do you take it? How many times a day? Those types of questions.
This is where it gets tricky because the TDF is once a day. And then the other medication, raltegravir, it's twice a day versus the other two are once a day. Trying to get the once a day options is absolutely recommended for teenagers. And the other thing for this particular scenario is that this is not a send a script and hope for the best. This is a send a script, call the pharmacy, speak with the pharmacist, and make sure that that medication is going to be accessible to your patient so that they're not held up by supply issues or copays or other things. And if you have access to your health system pharmacy, like a hospital pharmacy, this may also be a great scenario to utilize them.
And is this one of those situations where you just, when you choose between all those integrase inhibitors, you're just doing whatever we can physically get at a pharmacy now? Is that kind of how you make that choice, or is there a specific contraindication that we should know about for any of those integrase inhibitors?
No pressing contraindications for them. If possible, the dolutegravir is a once-a-day option that pairs nicely with the TDF that is once a day. But you're 100% correct. This is a whatever you can get because time is of the essence in this scenario.
Awesome. So let's assume that we can get dolutegravir and TDF together. And so we tell him, say we can even get it from our own Pyxis in our clinic because we're that good. Pull it, give it to him. Okay, here's your first dose. We'll make sure you have more. How long does he need to take this post-exposure as far as the prophylaxis goes?
For 28 days. And then there are several months of recommended follow-up to reassess Preston's HIV status.
And a question from there is, are these folks that you're ever going from PEP to PrEP, does that impact our transition to PrEP after they've completed that 28 days on PEP or the post-exposure?
Excellent question. It does not impact the transition, but it may be a great springboard to have that conversation of once the 28 days of PEP is finished, are you open to / I would recommend you continue the TDF as PrEP if we anticipate there will be ongoing risk or exposure.
All right. So it sounds like we're really finishing up on our HIV PEP PrEP. Before we move on, does anyone have any last thoughts, any last questions? Alex, did we miss anything that we should talk about?
I think there's one last thing I want to share, and that is about the minimum age for PrEP, which there is none. For all three of the medications, TDF, TAF, and cabotegravir, the minimum criteria is a weight of 35 kilograms or 77 pounds. So this is a medication that can be used in any patient who may be at risk, regardless of age, so long as they are at least 35 kilos.
Preston is also interested in other ways to protect himself against sexually transmitted infections. He's heard of something called DoxyPEP, and he asked you more about it. So what exactly is DoxyPEP, and who are some candidates that you think about?
I will commend Preston for doing this research, whether it is from a reputable source or just TikTok or Reddit. DoxyPEP is an abbreviation for doxycycline post-exposure prophylaxis. And this is really a new kid on the block. The first presentations were in, I believe, 2023, so just 2 years ago, has moved pretty quickly to being a off-label but evidence-supported way to prevent sexually transmitted infections for folks who are at higher risk. Now, for Preston, he is outside of the risk recommendations at this time. DoxyPEP is recommended for folks who are assigned male at birth, who engage in sex with other folks assigned male at birth, who are 18 and older. So that's the window of recommendation. However, there is, of course, an asterisk at the bottom of these recommendations saying that DoxyPEP can and should be considered on a case-by-case basis for other individuals who may be at high risk. So let's say, you know, when Preston's done his research, let's have a conversation about it. DoxyPEP, it is an antibiotic that is taken to prevent the acquisition of chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis. If done within 72 hours of sex that did not involve a condom, so higher risk sex. The way I like to teach DoxyPEP to my patients and to other folks in the healthcare system is 3-2-1. So you want to take DoxyPEP within 3 days of having unprotected sex. You want to take two pills or 200 milligrams as a one-time dose. And then the one comes into play again, because if you are having multiple occurrences of higher risk sex, you are only taking this once per day. So 3-2-1.
And this is an interesting concept, right? Because this is doxycycline, which we understand to be a medication that treats some of these STIs, but not all of them when we're providing treatment doses, but yet we think it prevents all three. Can you tell us a little bit more about this?
I am also fascinated by this. So you're 100% correct. This is a medication that is effective at treating chlamydia and treating syphilis. And actually we're using it now that we're in a penicillin shortage. For gonorrhea, I don't think the mechanism is 100% clear. Some of the proposed mechanisms include that it is doing some sort of partial damage to the gonorrhea bacteria, just enough to prevent it from taking up residence and causing an infection. That in treating other STIs, you are reducing an inflammatory response and therefore maintaining a protective barrier against the gonorrhea. I think the other through line in this is, are we unintentionally causing bacterial resistance? So this is something that is being closely studied. So far, the evidence that's been published does not show any increased resistance within those gonorrhea strains than folks who have taken DoxyPep. But I think this will be an area of ongoing investigation for years to come.
A follow-up question I had to this is, what does the actual prescribing practice look like? Is Preston having to write into your patient portal to request this? Do you normally have a standing order? What are practical tips you can give us on how to implement this in our practice?
Yeah, this is a great question that I will preface with, this is my expert opinion, in that I will ask about the expected risk. You know, how often a unprotected sex might happen in, you know, the next 3 months or so. And then very often I find myself rounding up to 30 and saying, all right, here are 30 tablets of doxycycline or 15 doses. I want to check back in 3 months. And if you have, you know, used up this medication before then, please message me for a refill so that, one, I'm aware of what's happening and that perhaps you are at higher risk. I might want to see you sooner. But then end that 3 month follow-up, we can check in about, one, have you been using the DoxyPep? And if so, how often? And do we need to do any other counseling or interventions in order to keep you healthy and safe?
And now this is kind of just a nuanced question there. When you are prescribing it to the pharmacy, how are you prescribing it? Like, you know, is this something that you're holding, just saying, hey, this is Lyme prophylaxis and take 200 milligrams, you know, once PRN exposure, and just kind of leaving it as hand wavy? You know, I'm just, you know, we've talked in a lot of other adolescent medicine episodes about these medications going to the pharmacy, confidentiality pieces, things that we can't really control for. And at the end of the day, and we encourage our adolescents to have open conversations with their folks for some of these reasons. But since doxycycline is just so common for various different things, I was curious if you have a practice on how you physically prescribe it.
That's a great question with, I think, a not straightforward answer. So, say, as a general practice, I try to be as honest with other elements of the healthcare system as reasonably allowed and protected. And of course, I am spoiled to be practicing in the state of Maryland, where there are a good number of confidentiality protections for our teenagers, and that I have yet to have any pushback from a pharmacy about prescribing or filling DoxyPep. Now, of course, this will vary based on where you might be practicing, and I think is a great conversation to have both with your patient, with Preston, and then potentially with a pharmacy, if you have a trusted pharmacy, or if you genuinely aren't sure how it might proceed. This is a great situation to go old school and pick up the phone and suffer through some hold music and talk to that pharmacist.
It's tough. You're asking me to call the pharmacy. I don't even know how many speak with a pharmacist.
I know. With a pharmacist. Just press zero until I get a human on the phone might be the key. But Alex, you are an adolescent medicine doctor. I know you work alongside a lot of general pediatricians in adolescent medicine clinic. I understand you're an expert. You're doing this type of care. But what about your colleagues in just general pediatrics? Is this something that all folks have the capacity to do?
Yes, all folks do have this capacity. Of course, knowing that DoxyPep specifically is currently recommended for those 18 and older, probably not a ton of prescription out of general pediatrics. But I think this is a really important tool that all of us should be aware of, even if we're not necessarily prescribing it on a regular basis. And I say this because over the past few years, we've seen increasing rates of STIs, especially amongst our adolescents and young adults. And I think we as a healthcare collective need to be working together to do everything possible to address this epidemic of STIs and to promote prevention amongst all of our patients.
And we'll even expand that, you know, to PrEP and PEP. You know, I mean, part of our mission here at the Cribsiders is also to teach the generalist through, you know, these interviews with you, just like we were curbsiding you in the doctor's lounge and saying, hey, this is what I would do and this is how I would do it, you know, go ahead and do it. But anything you see specifically, any tips that you would say for the PCP who's really going for something like PrEP or PEP, HIV PrEP or PEP when I say that?
So for us who work in primary care and have to balance so many things all at once, I think it's really important to know the resources and friends that you can call on. Even if you are practicing out in a more rural area, there is a national clinician consultation hotline for HIV PrEP and PEP that you can call to speak with someone who is an expert in that area and receive advice about what are the best next steps for your particular patient.
And are there any patients, Alex, that you just generally recommend just go ahead and refer to a specialty like Allison Medicine or infectious disease for management?
I think patients who may have more complex medical histories, patients who may be taking certain medications, especially anti-seizure medicines, which those are the ones most likely to interact with some of the, especially the integrase inhibitors, so like cabotegravir. Those are patients who I would consider referring to have a specialist kind of weigh in on what is the best path forward for that patient.
So are there any health equity challenges that you've come across while prescribing PrEP or PEP? And what can we do about it?
So some of the biggest challenges that our patients will have are going to be related to access. Access to providers who are knowledgeable in the areas of HIV, PrEP, and PEP, and even knowledgeable in treatment, screening and treatment of STIs. In access to pharmacies that have these medications available, and insurance plans that will cover these medications for patients who are at risk. I think this is really highlighted, especially in urban areas where there are higher percentages of minority populations, in which we are doing a huge disservice by not offering this more routinely, knowing that there are higher rates of STIs and HIVs in many urban centers in the United States. And we can be doing more to advocate at the level of our own health systems. Many of us have pharmacies that are integrated within our health systems that we can utilize as resources. And many of us, as health systems seem to consolidate more and more, are connected to one or more insurance plans that we can be advocating for increased coverage and access for our patients.
I've really enjoyed this conversation, and I feel that much more empowered to like talk to the next patient that comes into my office about PrEP, PEP, DoxyPEP. And just curious, what are your main take-home points for our listeners, things that you would want to make sure that we leave this conversation with?
I think the biggest point is that all of us need to be taking a more active role in offering PrEP and PEP to adolescents and young adults who may be at higher risk for HIV and DoxyPEP for some who may be at higher risk for STIs, in addition to our excellent and routine HEDS screening that includes sexual health risks. I think we as a healthcare profession need to be making sure that we are educating our peers and colleagues so that we are all aware of, one, the existence of these medications and moreover these really wonderful tools for preventing illnesses that can have really high morbidity. And in that, the last thing is to be advocates for our patients, for our patients accessing these necessary healthcare tools, and for them fighting against the healthcare systems in that quest for access.
And thank you very much for sharing. Because of this, we'll hopefully be able to offer more patients because we have more information and we know how to do this now. Before we go, is there anything else you'd like to plug? We're already going to put in hotline numbers. We're going to put in resources as well. Anything else that you want to plug for our listeners? Now's your opportunity.
Gosh. No, if someone wants to send me like a grant or two, that's all I can ask for.
Yeah, grant for Alex Golek, everybody. That's what we're looking for. we're gonna be good. All right, perfect. Well, thank you again for coming on tonight. This was fantastic, and I'm ready to go prescribe, whether it be inpatient or outpatient.
Awesome. I know. I love Crystal just kind of circling, being like, "Hey, we could do this in the inpatient setting."
Exactly. All right. Thanks again.
All right. Thank y'all.
This has been another episode of the Cribsiders.
It's for the kids.
Get show notes and sign up for our bi-weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
And we're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks to our producers for this show, Doctors Crystal Dewara and Coleman Birch, and our wonderful social media team, which is mostly Denise Cruz and X Blue Sky on Instagram. I've been Sam Mazur.
I've been Coleman.
I've been Crystal Nora.
And if you've been listening this far, please tune in to next week's episode to hear Chris the Chew Man Chew give you another poem from AI.